So hello everybody, I would like to introduce you to Christian Roy. Christian is an independent scholar. He has written a book on traditional festivals, which you can probably see just behind us here. He is on the International Jacques Ellul Society Board. So he's an expert on Jacques Ellul. He's also an expert on technicity, the media, and he also happens to be a member of my parish and a friend of mine. And so we've been talking for a while about symbolism. He also has a very deep interest in orthodoxy and symbolism and how all of this comes together. And so we're going to have a discussion which is going to center around technicity, the author Jacques Ellul, who's he's an expert on, but it'll probably spill over into all kinds of interesting things. And so I'm really looking forward to talking with him.
This is Jonathan Peugeot. Welcome to the symbolic world.
Maybe you can tell us a little bit more about yourself and maybe a little bit about you were just at a conference just now in Toronto. Maybe you can tell us a bit about that.
Yes, it was the 28th annual conference of the Media Ecology Association. And it was in Toronto, which happens to be one of the seats of, in a sense, of reflection on media as an issue, in a sense, philosophically, but also practically. There's such a thing as the Toronto School of Communication, including such luminaries as Marshall McLuhan and Northrop Frye, the great biblical scholar, even Glenn Gould, the pianist that had some interesting thought and practice around the new uses of media. The list could go on, but one can point out here that for many of these people, I want to think also of the great Jesuit Father Walter J. Ong, who worked on the contrast between oral and written alphabetic cultures. Many of these cultures, many of these thinkers have in common that they have a very deep personal faith that informs all their thinking. And it's certainly no coincidence, because being rooted in tradition is possibly the best vantage point to have enough distance from our modern environment, which most of us take for granted, to see what's actually happening, to see the patterns from a certain distance and by, for instance, historicizing it or being rooted in an actual religious practice, when you enter into an experiential world that is not the same as the modernity around you. And of course, have the mental patterns to have imbibed intellectually this whole tradition, to have categories to point out these differences with the current times and the evolutions that happened over time, the transformations. An interesting way of characterizing this media ecological approach, as it's been termed, is that in it, media are not means as not seen as means of transportation of data, but of transformation of human beings of ways of being, because they all involve different foci of attention with different senses, different relations to time and space that are entailed, all refashioned by different by new ways of communication. In communication, is not a new neutral conveyance of one bit of data to another from point A to point B. That everything is in the way of. The common way of being and of moving between these two artificially separated points. It means being in media res, in the Latin expression, being in the middle of things.
Right.
To understand that gap, which isn't a gap, that's where the life actually is.
Yeah. And I think that it's so important to talk about this now, because I would say that for several decades, we were presented media as almost a transparent Yeah. We were, people were trying to convince us that media was transparent. It was only this means of transparent communication. But now, as political discourse starts to fragment, as conflicts start to arise in society, we're noticing more and more to what extent selection, even just the selection of information that attention is being pointed to, is already such a frame that to imagine then even the actual structures of the media themselves, their matter of distribution, the way they frame space or they frame sonority, all of this.
Attention.
Yes. The way that they frame attention ends up manipulating, not necessarily manipulating, but participating in the way that information is received. And because of the breakdown, we see it more and more because we can see our enemy do it.
Yeah.
We know we don't see that we probably do it too, but we can see our enemy do it because we have that distance from what's going on.
And we have actually, because we frame our discourse and communication in the same way, we have much more in common with our current so-called adversary or enemy that we did with the people we claim, say, to return to, you know. We're part of the same world, and that's what's important to understand, because that's the constant trap. Of course, there's been plenty of movements that have been critical of modernity. Okay, we'll just mobilize against that. See, but counter-revolution assumes revolution. It takes the same forms.
Yes,
it's all based on project mobilization. So you end up, you may invoke some values from the past, but in practice, that you're actually a modern movement, and one probably even more efficient as a modern movement, because you have the reassuring references to the past.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you see, happens. I mean, some of the fascist groups did try to let's say, use some traditional ideas or some imagery, traditional imagery, but it was only a way to give a fuel to their modern project.
Yeah, or they might not, well, we can't even give them the benefit of the doubt. Maybe they were even sincere about it, they were fooled by thinking, okay, we just have to take sides firmly against that and mobilize our energies against, but mobilization is already modernity. And the more you're fully mobilized, the more modern you are.
Yeah, yeah. So maybe let's go with Ellul, because Jacques Ellul is a thinker that I do not know much about. But many people who watch my videos, many people who I'm in contact with, they keep telling me that I need to spend some time with Ellul and to understand him a little more. And so it's, I knew that I had my expert here with me. And so this is my chance as well to discover a little bit about him. Maybe you can tell us a bit about his own, because he converted to Christianity, and then his own intellectual progress, you could say. What are the things that were important to him?
Well, I'm tempted to approach this as a historian in terms of events. What is Ellul known for? Well, it's for he burst onto the scene, actually the international scene and the English speaking scene in particular in 1964 with the translation of his already 10-year-old book on technique, as he called it. It was translated as the technological society.
Yeah.
So he came to global awareness in 1964, but that was just 35 years after he'd been sort of involved in that scene. But there's significant anecdotes about how that came about, because it's Aldous Huxley who came across the original French edition from 1954, and he was so impressed by this description of technique as it was, and he thought, well, that's matches what I described in Brave New World, and it's important to bring this out at this moment where we're being refashioned by technology in all ways. So he convinced by different channels the publisher Knopf to publish this translation. It had quite an impact on 60s cultures, and but the irony is that actually when Aldous Huxley's book came out in 1930. Brave New World, it came out the same year in French translation. It was picked up by Ellul and his friend Bernard Charbonneau, actually, who said, well, wait a minute, that confirms what I've been thinking on my own.
Right.
So
there was an influence of Huxley on Ellul, and then Ellul came back to Huxley.
The point is they were thinking the same way,
right.
But they hadn't. It took them 30 more years to become aware. See, but it was only one way, because Huxley couldn't have suspected that someone was thinking, almost kids were thinking the same way in France, southwestern France, in Bordeaux, in 1930, and they had already devised a kind of critical and even revolutionary approach to counter these phenomena, which they saw in their daily life. And when I say they, it has to be said that it was this friend that Jacques Ellul came to know a couple of years before, called Bernard Charbonneau, who he acknowledged that he wouldn't have said anything original in terms of social ideas without meeting him. It would just have been. See, you have to understand that Jacques Ellul had a kind of twin conversion around 1930. He had a conversion experience to Christianity, which he understood in terms of Kierkegaard and Karl Barth on the one hand, and on the other hand, because his father was ruined by the economic crisis, he had a kind of conversion to Karl Marx. So
okay.
Karl Marx.
Whoa.
And Karl Barth both form two forms of dialectic.
Mm-hmm.
So it's in terms very much of dialectics of mutually exclusive opposites.
Mm-hmm.
So that was his framework at the time that he came across Bernard Charbonneau, who sort of took the place in his social thinking of Karl Marx.
Okay.
But he remained a Marx expert all his life. But basically, he would have been some sort of Christian Marxist if he hadn't come across this almost a class clown at the school they were going with, who one day came over to Jacques Ellul, who was kind of a nerd, really a bookish kind of guy, and invited him to a camping exhibition outside, and then in the countryside, and then they had these unending discussions. And Jacques Ellul was sort of overwhelmed by Charbonneau's sort of effortless grasp of culture, but most importantly, his way of seeing the patterns in embodied daily life. And he had already come to certain realizations about the nature of technological modern society that few people would come around to. You know, Heidegger and Frankfurt School were still some few years off.
Mm-hmm.
But on his own, just by there's two experiences that are foundational for Charbonneau's intuition of technique. Is one that realizing that the Bordeaux streets in which he'd grown up from almost overnight, the cats and the children had disappeared. They were replaced by cars.
Yeah.
Overnight, the city had turned from a human environment to a network of pathways for the circulation of these mechanical motorized engines.
Yeah.
And that was true of the whole of society.
That's right.
But no one talked about it. I mean, it was the time of the Great Wars, et cetera, and after.
Mm.
So, and of course, that it was also a motorized war. But he understood also, because he was too young to go to war, but he saw his big brother come back and being shell-shocked, incapable of talking about his experience. And what struck him is the way a society can be mobilized in the people's minds, as well as all the resources of the territory it controls. See, there's something similar and comparable about the impact of something like the car and modern war as a demonstration of what industrial society really is.
Mm.
The mobilization of everything in human reality as resource to be concentrated by the means to deploy this apparatus for whatever end. The end doesn't matter. The point is the mobilization in itself. And he understood that well, things like world wars or totalitarianism, they were just out of the ordinary expressions of something that was just the fabric of daily life as it had mutated. Mm-hmm. He called this the great molting of mankind. Once a man has triumphed over nature, it's no longer something that pressures him so much. But for that, a man had to rely on total social organization. So now he has to defend, man has to defend against society as his new environment, his second nature. So he understood that the struggle, the both personal freedom and nature are imperiled by modern society for the same reasons. And mm-hmm. therefore they are a common cause. See, I've shown that he was the inventor of political ecology in France and possibly worldwide in the 1930s. See, people mm-hmm. think it's something that started in America or Germany in the 1960s, but the movement that he started locally with Elul can be seen clearly as a kind of ecological revolutionary movement. Conceived at that, not in terms of fighting this and that idea or that ideology, but the common structures of the modern world, the state, the media, propaganda, modes of transportation, and the true changes would affect how people eat, how they read their paper.
Right. So how do you see that this is taking a little bit of a tangent, but it's interesting to me because what seems to have happened now in the, let's say, in the way that things have set themselves up is that the modern state and the modern media apparatus, all of this has now taken over the ecological discussion and is using it for its own means. It seems to be using it to also to let's say to manipulate people into certain directions. It doesn't seem to have anything revolutionary about it anymore.
Well, exactly, and no one was better placed than Bernard Charbonneau to point this out in the first decade of the actually existing French ecological movement, which was sort of started seemingly out of after 1968. In 1980, he came out with a book which he called, well, The Green Light, The Self-Critique of the Ecological Movement, which I translated for Bloomsbury last year. It's the only Charbonneau book out there. So, and that has good introductions to his talk, not by me, but so if people want to know more about Charbonneau, that's it. But he could, with this experience going back 50 years, he could see that the green movement had gotten mired in the quest for media attention, and for presence in the political system, which of course is paid by with media attention. So this critique of media is as a kind of a categorical imperative of our presence in this world is central to his critique of what the Green Movement had become. And now it was in turn, he calls it the Green Light because it's 1970 was decreed as the year of the environment by the Council of Europe. See, so it's no one would touch this topic in Europe, you know, until then. But it was a red light. I knew it personally because he'd written tons of books about it, and no publisher would touch it. See, and all of a sudden, 1970, it comes from the Council of Europe. Everyone broaches these issues. The greenwashing pump was started rolling because it started from bureaucratic center. So it was already a kind of discourse that sort of papered over the same kind of society and the people who were trying to challenge this kind of society. They sort of they took, by taking on the same means through which this society propagated itself, well, they were sort of co-opted by it. See? Yeah. So that's why you have a kind of green version of the same kind of technological society.
Yeah. It's interesting because what I've seen, because I look at my kids, you know, we do homeschool, but they use sometimes books from the school system and everything. And I can see that it seems to be replacing the kind of guilt system that was in the Catholic Church in the 1950s and 60s, where you had to really feel guilty about being alive, basically, you know, to being a human, you was being a sinner, and you had to live in this guilt. And now we've replaced that kind of original sin guilt with this guilt of living in consumer culture where you have to consume and you have to buy things wrapped in plastic. You can't avoid it, but then you have this guilt. So you have to atone, you have to recycle, all these gestures, these kind of social things you have to do in order to atone for your sins of just existing in the world. And you can see in the books, like my son has a math book. And in his math book, all the problems are all, if you cut so many trees in this area, you know, how long will it take for the trees, if they grow in such years, how long will it take for them to grow back? So it's like all the mathematical problems have become ecological problems. And it really struck me because I heard that in Quebec in the 40s and 50s, the math problems were all Catholic. They were all calculating how many chalices are used and everything. And so I thought, wow, it's a great way to indoctrinate children is to...
How many Chinese you can convert? Chinese kids
can you convert? And so it seems like it has become that this, you know, even though I can understand the need for ecology, I find myself resisting, not at the idea that we have to take care of the world around us, but I find myself resisting because I see it now as part of this apparatus, this kind of strange techno powerful apparatus of control.
Well, yeah, and one of the points that Charbonneau made early on is that probably the needful ecological environmental measures would not come about as the effect of some grassroots activism by marginal groups. It's when the very people who had managed the exploitation and ruin of the earth, well, they couldn't do that anymore. They would manage trying to rescue something of it. See, but it would be the same people, right. The same system.
Right.
But so that even called it, well, it for him it raised the specter of eco-fascism because it was one illustration of the way the chaos that is spread by this constant encroachment of organization needs to be managed by still more organization, which in turn generates more chaos. So this builds up the drive towards social totalization, which he saw a danger of the industrial system reversing to a kind of management of growth to a management of endless consumption, to a management of scarcity where everything would be precisely accounted for.
Wow.
But at the cost of personal freedom. And yeah. The point with the big difference between him and say deep ecologists who want to make you guilty for being a human, having you roamed the earth, is that for him even the sense of nature that these of something to be appreciated and preserved, this can only occur to a human.
Yeah.
So he was just as concerned and as for the preservation of freedom as for nature, which was for him in practice indistinguishable. For him, freedom was a very physical thing. It was, you know, that in his childhood, he used to go that almost down the street and be in the forest. And as years went by, the suburbs would eat up more and more. And nature, as a concrete experience, was inaccessible. And you are in a complete, box store or environment, and you can't get anywhere except by car. For him, that freedom and nature are one in that experience of deprival that industrial society creates. It curtails both concrete freedom as the ability to move around in a differentiated space in the elements of air and water and earth, and also free of having to follow standard procedures for everyday daily life. I mean, our so-called instruments and devices are not neutral. You know, in order for them to work, well, we have to adjust our behavior to them. We have to speak their language, or even when they pretend to imitate ours, but it's so that we can integrate more their way of thinking, of operating. See, we have to become interoperable with our machines, which have to become interoperable with each other. That's one of the things that Ebud is famous for underlining, these different laws of technique as the search for the one best way in every possible procedure in the area of life. And as a totalizing process, because you can't just have it in one area and leave the other areas inefficient, because it just won't work. In order for something to work efficiently, it has to work efficiently with everything else. It has to be connected by the same rules to everything. So if you introduce one improvement in one area, everything has to fall in line with it. You have to, and of course, since the improvement continues, everything has to constantly adapt to these new changes and even more efficiently and quickly. See, so there's ever increasing in conformity and standardization, even as the process that drives it is the quest for convenience, personal freedom of choice, right, whatever.
And then because of that interdependence, and because things end up speeding up by the fact that everything has to adapt to themselves and the efficiency has to grow in every aspect, then we realize that we've become slaves to our, that we've actually, like you said, that we're cyborgs already.
Yeah.
And we are completely dependent on these machines. And if we didn't see it, let's say, or very few people saw it with the automobile, although now we can see it from a certain distance, we can see exactly what you said, that now the entire layout of society has been made for cars.
Yeah.
We have planned our cities in terms of cars, but with the cell phone, that has now, I mean, I think almost everyone who has any form of self-consciousness is aware of that problem, of the problem of how we end up adapting our life to this object.
Well, our life means, which means concretely our sensorium, our management and awareness of space and time. People, there have been articles, by people whose job it is, or not just their job, but their pleasure in life was to read books and comment upon them. And they've observed that their attention span has drastically diminished. They can't read a couple of paragraphs without fidgeting to check their emails, because they've been literally rewired. I mean, our synapses our neural networks are sort of they become restructured by the stimuli that we become used to and addicted to. We've already been changed.
Yeah, we are cyborgs. We don't have them attached to our bodies to be cyborgs.
Well, that may come. Of course, the phones will soon be inside our skulls, but that won't make that much of a difference, because we already are inside them.
Yeah.
We wear them, or they may be wearing us.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very fascinating. And I think that maybe I'd like to hear you talk about something you mentioned just before. You were kind of going through and you mentioned the relationship between the system, the increasing of the system, let's say, and the increasing of chaos at the same time, and then the reaction of the system to that process, let's say. That's something that really interests me. As you've followed some of my videos, I tend to talk about how the modern world seems to actually be a rising of extreme system and extreme chaos at the same time.
Exactly.
And that those two things are coming up together because one feeds the other.
Exactly. Right? That's exactly what Charbonneau was saying. He wrote a whole book on that. Yeah.
So maybe tell us a little bit about how Charbonneau frames that. It's hard to resume small bits.
I know. Where do you take it from? Because it's also it's at the level that we're so embedded in that kind of reality that we don't see it. So where can you sort of pull it to a certain distance and say, oh yeah? Let's assume somewhat pre-modern conditions. There are local customs, regular ways of doing things over a certain area, and they tend to vary from locality to locality, etc. So we'll bring in a road, or we'll electrify. What happens? Well, pretty soon the whole activity, rather economic or social, can sucked up by interaction with this road or with the TV that just came in. Well, you know, and millennia or hundreds of years of custom just disappear overnight with the appearance of a TV screen, you know. Yeah. I remember my first experience of strolling through a French village deep in the Burgundian countryside in 1980. I was struck walking at night that there would be no one out there, and you would see these screens flicker in every house. And probably that wouldn't have been the experience 30 years before. Right. Yeah. Yeah. that all these people who had these very particularized local experience, ways of spending time together, maybe around the fire after supper, etc. All of a sudden, they had this one common awareness coming through the TV screen, this one common folklore which overcame and erased generations and centuries of ways of interacting or making sense of the world. It would mean, for instance, well, you know, even the local languages. It's well known that France wasn't a French-speaking country until 120 years ago.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Because most people would speak their own language. Same thing in Italy.
Yeah.
There's two things that made most Italians speak Italian. There was the forced sort of standardization policies of the fascist regime, but even that was an outgrowth of the First World War, which peasants from everywhere and just put them in
one place to fight.
Threw them in the Alps. You know, the people who've been grown up in Sicilies and never been to the next village. All of a sudden, they were shooting Austrians and high in the Alps. And they were treated, and the Italians were the worst at treating their own soldiers. I mean, it would be a temptation to go over to the other side because they wouldn't be asked. It's no wonder that fascism came out of that. See, mm-hmm. But that's where everyone learned Italian, mm-hmm. on the front lines and in the barracks. The same thing for every modern nation state, which means the elimination of all these particular cultures everywhere. And that was one of the big issues that Chaboneau had. I guess he had in mind some kind of an international of local homesteads or local areas, because he even saw the nation state as a stage to a kind of global uniform consciousness, because the nation states are not they're modern creations. You know, they're premised upon the centralization and uniformization within within certain boundaries. Well, the central the language and outlooks of the central government would be imposed throughout the whole society. So the effects would be linguistic, but they've also you had to school them, of course, mm-hmm. to take them out. There's a famous book by historian Eugene Weber describing this process called From Peasants to Frenchmen. So that's about what the Third Republic did in the late 19th century by basically taking all these peasants out of the Middle Ages and putting them in rows in the secular schools of the Republic and just stamping their uniform consciousness and punishing them if they spoke their own language like Breton, etc.
Yeah.
So in a sense, globalization continues this process, but then with softer means, but more like through seduction.
Yeah.
I guess TV had done that on the national scale before, but there's a kind of soft totalitarianism inherent just to the technical system that probably works better in many ways when it's not under a hard totalitarian political regime. The way American pop culture is the kind of universal language of that, and it, wherever there's any kind of electric media, well, that has imposed itself as the kind of universal norm, you know.
But what's interesting about the American pop culture is that, especially the music, was that it was positing itself as a reaction.
Yeah,
right. It's positing itself as a kind of rebellious declaration of the individual, of giving into your desires, not participating in the system, but then it just got sucked into the same process, right?
Yeah.
It became, like you said, a kind of uniform language of rebellion that could be managed because we all knew what it was. Like, you can recognize a punk from every country, because they all look the same.
Yeah, these alternative rebel cultures became just there was this term that arose, in the early 80s when I grew up, in record store there would be the rock bin and then the alternative bin, but there were still records being marketed and made exactly the same way. You just have the mainstream consumer niche, and then you have the very alternative consumer niche. They're still consumer niches. Mm-hmm. They all function. They're all the same. So that's one of the ways in which the medium, the format, is much more important than the content. You have different contents of the same structure of individual mass consumption, mm-hmm. Which is not being very refined, by finding these ever finer niches of aesthetic or ideological association, which by being identified by the proper algorithms, then you can tailor make things so that they will meet their expectations and therefore standardize them even more, because they're made to fit what they receive, and they develop a taste for it and forget whatever can trouble this form of sensibility that becomes self-referential and fortified in its own assumptions, and the more ever more intolerant of anything that disturbs it in the same way. There's less and less distance between desire and gratification, or actually we expect being gratified. Actually, maybe gratification comes first, and then this desire goes to meet it.
That's intense. But I've seen that myself in my own experience, now putting out YouTube videos, I start to perceive the algorithm. And the content that I'm doing is strange. It doesn't, because I'm talking about symbolism, religious symbolism, but then also movies and everything. And so I can see that the algorithm is struggling to fit me.
To place right? you, yeah.
But then once in a while I make a video, and I know when I'm making the video that I'm going right into the algorithm. Like I made a video to call Alex Jones the symbolism of conspiracy theory, symbolism of Alex Jones, right? And that I knew when I put that out, that video, and I did another video called Symbolism of Propaganda.
Yeah.
And I knew when I put out the video that I was going right into kind of anti-social justice, whatever, part of the algorithm.
Yeah.
And exactly what I expected happened. Within a few weeks I had 100,000 views, but then I was like, then that's dangerous, because it says, okay, well, if I make more videos like that, then I can keep the attention.
Yeah.
So you have to whip yourself to not be something that feeds the machine.
Yeah.
And I've seen YouTubers do exactly that, where for a while I was interested in their content, then all of a sudden they found this wheel that they can feed, and then they just put out all their content ends up being the same kind of stuff.
They become formatted by the algorithm.
Yeah. And they don't realize it, because it's really like you get a pellet, because you get views, you get likes, you get even money from advertising. Oh, yeah. Yeah, so it's very frightening. But what do you think about, because there seems to be, right now on the internet, there seems to be a war of information. You have the big tech companies trying to censor. You have alternative tech companies coming out and then not being, like Gab, for example, doesn't even appear on Google and was branded right away as an extreme right wing group. But I mean, it wasn't more, the people on Gab weren't more right wing than the people on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a kind of like the guy, one of the mass shooters recently. I remember the articles that came out right away when they came out. They said a Gab user, so and so, went in and shot a school. But that person was also on Twitter and used Twitter and Gab equally.
Yeah.
But then they said the Gab user, because Gab was pariah in the information control that seems to be going on. We see in Patreon, we saw censorship. We're seeing it on YouTube. We're seeing demonetization and like little ways to push the attention of people in some directions. It seems to be becoming more transparent, because also because of 2020, because the election is coming, and you can see that they're trying to direct the people's information for so. But what's interesting is that you're actually seeing a war, because when television was there, you didn't see the war. There was no war, right? There was three networks in the United States, and there were and Canada with CBC, and there was that was it. Like that was they were feeding you with a spoon.
Yeah,
like, this is reality.
Yeah.
Just take it. Whereas now it feels like there's a war for reality.
Yeah,
you know,
which reality do you want? And then you'll get the whole worldview that comes with it, the whole package of that take on reality, which doesn't need to fit anything out there particularly, because it's the whole, well, it's the virtual reality experience of having this complete experiential worldview as complete unto itself. It doesn't matter if your guy's in power or not. It's the same mental universe.
Okay, so this is what's interesting in what you're saying, is that to a certain extent what you're saying is that, let's say there's several parties that are fighting this war, information war, that in a certain manner it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Because the two sides have accepted the same reality, the same frame.
Yeah.
And so because of that, it does, in a way, it doesn't matter who wins, because what matters is the medium itself, or the manner in which information and technology, it's the power that has, which is the most pernicious, we could say.
Yeah. And the way, whichever brand of reality you're into, well, your brain will be sucked onto your screen or your handheld device, and you won't pay attention to your immediate surroundings, you know, and that's the upshot. You will be more and more a kind of organ of resource of that invisible wireless organism out there, which is now the real subject of, I guess, post-human history. And, you know, it comes back to, you know, one of McLuhan's famous aphorisms. Humans are just the sex organs of the machines. They still need us, you know, as a kind of third party to make a little detour through, you know. But of course, we're promised a singularity where they will self-reproduce.
Yeah. Right?
They won't need us anymore.
Yeah. But the singularity question is very interesting, because what we're seeing is this: we can feel that we're slaves to this process, because you have people warning, you have all these people afraid of this of the AI and what the AI will be, and we have a whole mythological storytelling, Terminator, The Matrix. We have this whole mythological storytelling which is warning us of that problem, but we know that it's inevitable. Because there's so much money and there's so much power that the fight is gonna happen.
The fight is just a one mode of entertainment within the same media, you know. Because whether you relish the prospect or dread it, you're still fascinated by it, and you still pay bucks to see entertainment on that theme.
That question.
And it's still going. Seeing these dystopian movies doesn't inspire people to get off the grid. No, they want to see more of that genre. See, to feed their obsessions, which are not different in kind from those of porn watchers, you know, which they probably are, and when they're not watching that, because also it's the same logic: getting kicks of intensity, you know, having I guess some of your. Some of the levers of your psyche pulled in efficient ways, you know. It's entertainment has whatever its content has the same underlying the same logic. So we're hooked on the spectacle of our own demise. You know, it's the most entertaining way of approaching it.
It is fascinating, because we had a slew. It's a bit less now, but we had a whole slew of, you know, end of the world movies in the 2000s. It was nonstop. Every year there was two or three comets, you know, everything, earthquakes. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
You know, like, and we recently, there was a whole slew of, they remade the Planet of the Apes, in which the apes are the heroes, and the human beings are the bad people, the bad guys.
Yeah.
And so we are actually watching, we're watching our own demise, you know.
Yeah.
And we're rooting for the other, like we're rooting for the enemy, and this strange fascination with the demise of humanity.
Also the constant suggestions, you know, that machines might be, well, you know, Terminator 2 was still optimistic. If machines can become more human, maybe we can too. And then you have also all these robots who strive to become human, even because the humans, like, say, let's say in Alien 4, see, this ruthless military that indulges in horrible experiments. Well, if that represents humanity, then the little Winona Ryder android who reads the Bible then has more humanity. So we sort of do these transfers. We hope that there will be, among whatever succeeds us, whether it's animal or machine, there will be something that's less mindlessly mechanical than we are.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. Yeah, definitely, definitely. So maybe we can finish off about talking a little bit more about one of the things that has been interesting to me has been discovering the notion of technicity as a supplement, something that I've, you know, in terms of the garments of skin,
yeah,
and in terms of this idea of adding layers to something which is untouched or something which is pure. It doesn't really matter how you characterize it, but this constant adding of layers and the dual effect that it has on us. And obviously we're in an extreme version of this, and it's my understanding that group, like Ilu and McLuhan, they've also thought about that problem. So maybe we can talk about that a little bit and see.
Well, yes, because they're just, it struck me with your whole theory of garments of skin, there's something kind of like that in Elune. I'm not sure that he focuses that much on the garments of skin stage, which someone at the Media Ecology conference rightly pointed out. Well, that was the first technology, clothing.
Right.
And McLuhan said houses are also an extension of the skin.
Yeah.
Or in, so, but Elune in particular has a biblical angle to this. Of course, he's not just a sociologist. There's two streams to his thought, and they were sort of conceived and outlined together around the time of the war. There's the sociological description of the way modern society is, and then there's the theological assessment. And sometimes of the same topic, one kind of non-judgmental, relatively, because he's always kind of moralistic, really. And and then there's the openly theological side. And of course, being the Protestant that he is, he's a very, very thorough biblical scholar. So that he really analyzes the issues in terms of, well, the first chapters of Genesis, and he wrote a whole book on called the meaning of the city, as a critique of, well, these extensions of man that are city walls and gathering together as a kind of he sees it purely in terms of Babel as a conscious rejection of God to be in the self-enclosed human world. And to me, that's kind of over the top. I think you have more subtlety than that, and Charbonneau does too. And he sort of, there's a subtle hint in the Nature and Christianity chapter of Charbonneau's book, The Green Light, where there seems to be a subtle allusion to Elul. Sure, we have to find some shelter, etc. But we were expelled in nature. What do you expect? You know, it's like Elul sort of sees these protections that man finds in his actual conditions as inherently a kind of disobedience to God, and that's it. And then at the later stage, God in his mercy sort of integrates that after the fact in his plan of salvation. For him, the city is just a kind of man decided to live in cities, so I'll make a heaven in Jerusalem, so we can something is used to. So I think there's more. Yeah. I mean, there's deeper symbolism.
Yeah, yeah.
There are more serious more deeper reasons for that urban symbolism of the lasting that Elul allows, and I think it has to do Also with the fact that he doesn't have any notion of the icon. For him, it's just the idol.
Right.
When you represent something visually, that's all there is. You put a screen between you and God, and that's it. The idea of a mediation, of a healthy mediation with the outside and even with God through concrete to concrete objects is sort of anathema to his.
Yeah.
It's the kind of old Calvinist reflex.
Right. But that's interesting that he would see, at least he would understand that, you know, he would have the wisdom to understand that the city is that.
Absolutely.
That is, that he would understand that there's a relationship between the problem of the image itself or the idol or any form of exterior manifestation and the city, you know, and to see also the temple. It's, I mean, I don't know if he probably wouldn't go that far, but to understand that the temple is also that, you know, that the temple is already a hint of how the city, the enclosure, is transformed into something else.
Well, for that to have that discussion seriously, we need to read some of his writings on this topic. If we want to get into the theological aspects, which are very much there, always in the background in McLuhan, actually. So perhaps that could be a focus of some other discussion.
All right.
Because right now, I don't think either of us is truly prepared to get into that. We should do a little bit of more homework. Well, I'll leave you Charbonneau's book, which is chapter on nature and Christianity, and then you get really a grip of that, what I call the Bordeaux School's approach to these issues.
All right. Well, thank you so much. This has been a great discussion, and I hope that we can go more into Elul on this question, particularly because it interests me very much later. But then also talk about, I think it would be interesting for people to talk a bit more about McLuhan as well.
Of course.
Because he was such, I remember even when I studied in college and was studying in art and in the kind of postmodern world, McLuhan was a staple where people would quote him. And it's only later that I discovered that he was a traditionalist Catholic and that most of his analyses of what was happening was a critique and wasn't a celebration of
which most people took it as
and so I think that that's something that would be very interesting to look into.
Well, also Elul's notion of symbolism, because he has a very rigorous thinking about that, around the different status of the word and the image. Well, you can see how this relates to the iconoclastic strand. See, the is opposing a bit like McLuhan the oral world of the experience of the word and the visual experience, of course, of the image, which the visual world being that of the what he calls the real, as opposed to the oral world of the true, real, which comes from thing, because in Latin res, because you can focus on one thing at a time, sort of pin it down, and you see one aspect at a time, which is non-contradictory, whereas what makes the oral experience of things and of the word, of course, more symbolic, is that it sort of implies that it's never, whatever you get is not the whole picture. There's different aspects that you could get in time, and you could theoretically circle it. It's not a visual thing, like the bullet time of the Matrix, when you get it from all angles and add it up, and you'd have it. No. Oral experience is fundamentally different from that. There's always seemingly contradictory aspects that coexist, or even with what is given and is not given. See?
Yeah.
And that's it becomes a revelation of something not given that can come through an oral experience of the word or even of any perception. Because it's not so much an issue of using that organ as opposed to that, but what is the ratio in the use of this organ? Which organ structures the whole economy of your senses? You can you can hear things visually, and you can see things orally. See, that's McLuhan territory already.
All right.
These kinds of things.
Okay, well, I look very much forward to going in that direction. So, guys, thank you for your attention. And if you're interested, Christian is part of the Symbolic World Facebook group, and he is known to get involved in discussions. So so it might be a place where some of the discussion about this video we can have and see what kind of soil, what can grow out of this soil. So thanks again for your attention, guys, and I'll see you soon.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Symbolic World. The Symbolic World is edited by Justin Ward, and it is based on a series of videos that you can find on my YouTube channel, Jonathan Pajot's YouTube channel. You can also get involved. There is a Facebook group that has started by fans of the podcast called The Symbolic World Within the Zombie Invasion. I will put a link to that in the show description. And so it is a discussion of all things symbolism that is quite interesting. I'd like to drop in there and also leave some of my comments as well. You can always help the podcast by, of course, leaving a review on iTunes. Everybody knows that's the best way to get the podcast out there, to get it heard. And if you want to get involved, you can also support the podcast financially going to www.thesymbolicworld.com/support or else on Patreon, Pajot Videos as well, and on Subscribestar. All those links you can find on my website or in the show description. So thank you, and I will see you soon.